Hi, and welcome to CISPA TLDR, the podcast of the CISPA Helmholtz Center for Information Security, where we make sense of cybersecurity and AI without all the complicated stuff, so you can make sense of it without a computer science degree. Each month, we sit down with our researchers to talk about the challenges they're working on. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser from the communications team, and just so you know, I am not a trained computer scientist either. My guest today is Matteo Leonelli, a PhD student here at CISPA. Matteo joined CISPA in 2021, working as a research assistant during his master's thesis. Since last year, he's working on his PhD, where he's focusing on making systems more secure by finding new ways to test them. Great to have you here, Matteo. Welcome.
Thank you, Tobias. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about you first. You're originally from the north of Italy. How did you end up in Saarbrücken and working at CISPA in cybersecurity?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Like, that was a actually interesting story for me because I was working in a research center in my region, in Trento, in North Italy. And I was already working on research in cybersecurity. And it was the time for me during my bachelor to actually start my Erasmus period. And my supervisor at that time suggested me to go to Saarbrücken because it was known in CISPA. It was confident that it was really good research center and really educative place. So he strongly suggested me as one of the available options to actually go there. And I did my 6-month Erasmus. I continued with my master and here I am for the PhD. But I really found CISPA really intriguing for me, like, and really a good opportunity for research.
So you did not regret your choice?
No. I think work-wise, it's really interesting and the environment is perfect. I feel like it's really optimal.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. So then let's just dive into your current research, what you're actually doing in the last few years.
Yes, sure.
So currently, or recently, you have published a paper earlier this year where you looked into video decoding and you have found some interesting bugs in the hardware acceleration stack. Sounds complicated, so maybe let's start simple.
Yes.
When we watch videos online on our devices, what's actually going on under the hood? Why do videos have to be encoded? What is video hardware acceleration and why do we use it? Like, one at a time.
Okay, yeah, we break it down.
Yeah.
So first of all, when, for instance, you are working on your laptop or you're using your phone, I think is daily activity that we render some video. We actually, I don't know, on social media, on TikTok, on Instagram, you actually scroll your Reels or your TikToks. And basically what you do is like you're doing a request. So you're asking for a video to this kind of server that in this case could be represented from TikTok or Instagram. Mm-hmm. This video in the server is encoded. So that means that it's in a format that saves space because this video are complex string, let's say, is a lot of data in this and they're usually redundant. So they repeat the content a lot of times. So as you do for the zip file, what's happening is that you compress them and to save space as much you can. In this way, you can store more data in your server. And then what's happening when we actually are using our social media or our Netflix, our Amazon Prime or whatever service, what's happening is that we are requesting this video. We download it on our phone with this encoding in this encoded format. And basically what's happened, then our smartphone with this hardware acceleration start to decode it and allowed us to actually visualize it in a human readable form or like actually providing the actual video and output. So all this process, it's a little bit more complicated than we can imagine because there are different codecs, there are different technology that's came in. So, but the basic flow is that you want to watch something on Netflix, the server give you the movie in an encoded format, you decode it, you have your video and you can easily watch it.
Okay. And that process, as you said, is pretty complicated and it's probably also quite resource intensive. That's why you have hardware acceleration, I guess.
Exactly. Like the hardware acceleration components came in because even with our phone now, like the technology is really heavy on some degree because if you notice, even with your iPhone or with your phone, most of the time, I don't know, like your resources are drained from the battery and the battery is actually like going to die soonish. So these hardware acceleration components are in the one that we test, at least the video decoding hardware acceleration components is designed on purpose. It's basically a chip in your phone or in your laptop that what does is basically optimize this decoding process to make it faster, less intense. So basically it's a physical hardware components that optimize in a with this circuit that they are developed from, of course, the manufacturer that are they know what they do.
Hopefully.
Somehow, at least. Then maybe we get deeper in that. But yeah, so basically what's happening is that these components allow you to don't drain your phone battery too early and optimize and perform this decoding faster than the pure software will otherwise do.
Okay, okay. And that helps in the end, as you said, save battery resources. Like the one thing that is precious when you're going in a train and scrolling reels for 6 hours.
Optimize both resources and the speed that you could render this video. Otherwise, if you will use just the software, for instance, that will take definitely longer.
Okay, okay. And how did you decide to actually look into like hardware acceleration? I mean, that is something that is, as I would put it, quite hidden, I guess. So it's nothing that I as a user think about daily. So
So the hardware acceleration itself, so what we develop in the work that I early this year published and presented at the conference was basically more a testing strategy. Mm-hmm. So we took this hardware acceleration as a test case to show that our approach is effective. And basically my goal, at least because my interest, my background, basically I come from a computer scientist degree in my bachelor. So I was pretty confident with the software. But with the hardware, I didn't have many options to actually investigate. I always been curious about the hardware world or so on, but I missed, let's say, this bridge before in my education to actually be free to actually explore and see what's going on.
Okay.
So with this project, I found this genuine trade-off between software and hardware testing that allowed me to get a little bit into this world, understand what's happening under the hood, a little bit more in the details. And that's really fun. It was, of course, challenging, but for sure there was enough work every day to think about and work on. And I don't know, I was just genuinely interested in hardware components, and I thought video hardware decoding was a potentially daily problem even for final users that maybe are not just knowing what is going on, but that's a component that we have in our phone since a couple of generations, I would say, at least. I don't know, it are just these components that more likely people are not really knowledgeable about, but they actually impact our daily life potentially. So it was an interesting target for me.
Okay, okay. Yeah, it really sounds interesting. So, but before we get to the, as you said, you developed a new testing method that this is only basically an example of. But before we get to that, maybe let's just get back to the paper in general, because one of the problems that you described with testing hardware acceleration, hardware in general, is that it is often sort of a black box.
Correct.
So you put it as you enter something and you get out something, but it's unclear what happens on the way. And maybe you can explain a little bit more about that in detail, why that is hard to test in general.
So, yes, when we talk about black box in this work or in general in software or security testing, we refer to a system that we cannot have introspection. So I guess if you think about the source code and you can actually visualize your C code, your Python code or whatever.
So when we're talking about software.
Exactly. Yeah, when we talk about software, usually we talk about white box. That is actually the opposite of black box.
Yeah.
But maybe better do a little step back to explain the differences. So white box refer to actually a system that you can have introspection. You can actually open your editor, your text file, and actually see what the code should do. And if you know programming or programming languages, you could actually understand what does and get a feeling of what the code is doing and what the process of the pipeline is actually performing. When we're in black box, everything that we have is basically we give an input that in our scenario is a video file encoded. We give it to the hardware acceleration stack and we get the output video, and that's it. We don't have any other approach to actually physically open the hardware, attach a debugging, or actually understand what's going on. So we talk about black box because we are actually trying to test this hardware acceleration component or all the stack in this black box manner, where we can actually not physically have any introspection or in any other way, basically. So
right, and so in your paper, you basically introduced a solution to that problem.
Yes,
you called it TwinFuzz, which is also the title of the paper. What is it, and how does it work in sort of simple terms?
Sure, I try to give a simple explanation as I can. So TwinFuzz is a bit a name that we came out because we apply fuzzing to this project. So the fuzz suffix is because fuzzing, and twin because what we do is basically we basically analyze two different trays that are twins, but somehow they could be same, or like they could be two different twins. So what we do in basic term is that basically we give to a black box system that is these hardware components and to a white box that is the source code, basically the, our code, in this case in C code. We give the same input, so the encoded file. We make it process to these two different models, the black box, and the, so the hardware, and the white box, the software. And basically we see if the results agree. That's the basic takeaway of our strategy. In this scenario, basically, what's happened is a bit like giving a math problem to two different people and hope that both are knowledgeable enough to actually get the same solution and actually the correct solution. So what we basically can see is that either one or the other is not correct. And then here the challenge or like the complication, the complicated part came in, and we have to understand what's going on, because if it's in the software, as I say, it's a white box. So we can open our editor, look at the code and try to understand where it fails, what went wrong. With the hardware, you don't know, like that's way more challenging. So yeah, basically that's the short, long story short of our approach. And of course, most of the work was given from the analysis, because this black box system don't give you any introspection. So you actually have to kind of guess it, then check. And it's a lot of...
there are a lot of assumptions that you kind of have to see if they prove, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a bit based on experience, a bit of hard testing or smash your head until you don't get it to work. So yeah, in the end, it's it was really funny, but brings for sure some challenges when you work with lower level component or hardware component or this black box domain. So basically, what we did is this kind of approach that allowed us with a white box, so giving a guidance from the white box, so from the software. So basically, we have our software that should guide our execution, because that is we have access to that, so we can actually be sure that the flow, the code flow or the control flow is actually correct. And then we can actually see if the hardware component is actually processing the video in the same way and try to understand where or what are the kind of cases where this kind of, where when an input, for instance, give a bad result or actually some mismatching between the software and the hardware part.
Okay. Which explains very well the first part of the name, which is twin, right?
So exactly.
So you give both twins, like the hardware and the software, same thing. You check what the difference is in the end, and then you kind of get some idea of what's happening in the middle.
Exactly. If everything in an ideal world, will work perfectly, we will have like two twins that are always the same, but unfortunately is not always like that.
Okay. So maybe then let's get back to the second part of the name, which is fuzz. I mean, I have talked about fuzzing a few times in this podcast, sometimes more extent, sometimes just a little, but maybe you can give us a refresher on how it works and how it also like applies to your research in this case.
Yeah, for sure. Like, so my researcher, or at least my chair, is a system security chair. So what we try to do is just at least we are trying
very simple,
trivial immediately. No, but yeah, like in our chair we try to create tools that are prone to test complex systems. And what we do and what we apply most of the cases is fuzzing, that is fuzz testing. So basically it's a strategy that try to stress the software or the system that we are testing, throwing a lot of random inputs or unexpected to try to discover hidden bugs or bugs that are not so easy to find. For instance, I don't know if you have a web page that asks you your age, and for instance, you are expected to maybe have a reasonable value between zero and, okay, maybe zero not, but one at least, between, I don't know, one and 100 or something around these numbers. If you throw like a negative number or you throw, you insert a extreme high number like 10,000, let's say that sometimes the developer don't consider that the user could be malicious or the developer does not consider that people could be wrong. So basically, you have always to be careful of when you develop your code to actually manage edge cases that nowadays or for your specific scenario now could not be relevant. Yeah. But maybe if someone else deployed the same software in a more critical system, that could bring some difficulties, let's say.
Okay.
So yeah, basically what we do is testing this system and try to improve the security and the guarantees of these complex systems.
Okay. So you use fuzzing and you use basically comparing software as a proxy to explore what the hardware is doing.
Yeah, but exactly. That's a particular branch of fuzzing that's called differential fuzzing. Mm-hmm. That's, as the name could hint, basically you have two different execution and you try to understand, thanks to the disparities between like the software and the hardware, what's going on or when basically something is not acting as it should.
But how does this differential fuzzing work in your concrete example? How do you do fuzzing for video? That's something that is, I could imagine it with code, but with video, I mean, maybe you can explain how that works.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to keep it a bit simple. Yeah. But basically, on the software part, so basically we have again these two traces, the white box and the black box. Mm-hmm. So our software model and our, let's call it for simplifying, hardware model. And what's happening is that basically we first execute the input with the software part. So basically here there will be like some clear process between like the parsing of the input, the filtering, the coding itself in the software part, and then the optimization and finally the rendering. So basically we will throw this input. We'll have all this process in the software. Mm-hmm. And we'll end up with a final output that will be our video.
Yeah.
Then what's happening for the hardware is the same. It just, we don't know what's happening. We just give the video, black box, magic happen, and we have our video.
Yeah.
Then what we do at this stage, basically where we apply the differential part, basically here we take frame by frame the video and we compare if the frame content is actually the same for each part of the video. And that's for us, of course, is kind of expect that sometime like the two models can be, can not agree on the precise results.
Yeah.
But if we start to get a lot of these indication that the two frame compared like on the same video are actually different, that start to get an indication for our tool to say, hey, that could be an interesting case. Maybe there could be an edge case where it's not developed correctly, either in the software or in the hardware. And then our goal in the end is then to go in the details, go a little bit deeper in the rabbit hole and try to understand which is the responsible components, is the software part, is the hardware part. And when we identify which one for software, there is something we can do. We can try to provide more details for the developer that are responsible for this kind of software. But for the hardware, you potentially need to be really more more precise with the developer to make them understand what's going on, because you have to imagine that these people are developing this chip on specific purpose that they try to test at their best. And then maybe when something went wrong, since with black box, we just give an input and we get the output, it's hard to reverse engineering this kind of process and understand what's the critical part, because we cannot just open the hardware and say, hey, this is connector that is mismatched or replace it.
Okay, so but you're actually comparing like the output. So you have like, I don't know, you put in a YouTube video of a cat and then you take like frame number 10 and you like see it at the end of this decoding process and you can just compare what does frame 10 look like in hardware and what does frame 10 look like in software.
Yeah, basically that's the takeaway. Yeah.
Okay, but how does fuzzing go in there? Do you then edit the video with fuzzing so you get a lot of different inputs to test, or how does that look like?
Yeah, so basically fuzzing came in when we want to like generate new inputs. So basically, let's say the standard process is, as I explained, like there is this kind of input, goes in these two pipelines, and then they converge in the differential part where we compare them. And then after this comparison, basically we give some feedback to our fuzzer. We say, hey, look, this frame, there was this part that was not actually the correct ones. So what's happening is that thanks to this feedback, our tool understand what could be potentially the part of the bytes or the part of the video that could be responsible for that, and throwing, like generating hundreds, thousands of inputs, basically, it tries to figure out always more what could be the condition that make it crash or make it actually like find something that is not so clear, that this is disparities, basically. And basically continue with this loop of generating, executing, and providing this feedback. We continue to test this kind of components. And the nice part here is that since we talk about hardware stack in general, what we consider is like all the machine, in this case, all your laptop or your smartphone. So we test the full stack. In this way, it means that you have all your software, your operating system, that could be Mac OS, could be Windows, Ubuntu, or whatever you like. And you could have different version of the library. So there are a lot of components that could be different. So that approach somehow allowed you to test even your specific machine. So it's really specific to the machine where it's run. And that's allowed you to test potentially like, thousands of combinations.
I think in the beginning you said that in a perfect world, software, the software stack would behave the same way as like the hardware acceleration stack.
Exactly.
But since we're not in the perfect world, it obviously didn't, right?
Yeah, since we publish and we get some interesting results, we actually find something that it was not working as expected. So yeah, we find actually some bugs in both the stacks, both hardware, like on the hardware part or and in the software as well. The software ones, as I said, are pretty trivial. Once you identify them, you can easily report them to the developer, because we tend to, we actually like want to have a correct disclosure of this kind of security bugs, because it could affect different people. So we want to be report them at our best. And for the software part, we collaborate with the developer to identify with our help the issues. They fix it and they release the new version with the patched with the patched code. For the hardware, we had to like be more careful. Some part where, for instance, a communication between the drive, like between the software part and the hardware part. So, for instance, these kind of bugs where it's a bit fault of the software, it's a bit fault of the hardware. That's bring a little bit more challenging and open some other discussion on that. But in the end, even collaborating with Intel, we actually like were able to solve the issues, and we got even acknowledgement, and they actually told us that our work could be really a good fit for their testing strategies. So we were really happy about our results.
Really cool. And I in your paper, I saw that you also found, like, as you said, you found some bugs, but you found actually vulnerabilities that include like major apps like Firefox and VLC, the classic media player. What kind of issues did you uncover? And more importantly, how would they actually affect someone? So because not every bug is the same, right? So there might be a bug that will just give you your computer sort of a small hiccup, and after a second everything will continue and you might be none the wiser. Others will crash your system, others might leak your data. So what did you find, and could it actually be of any interest to a normal user, because it's dangerous?
Okay, so like I guess the goal of research is like to be ahead of potential attacker that could exploit this system. So I, at least from in my opinion, what we try to do is trying to be ahead of potential malicious attacker and try to investigate this system and find the potential vulnerability before like someone malicious will actually do the same and could then become a threat for the final user. So what we do is actually security testing to actually improve our state of the art technology and always be bug-free, more bug-free as possible. So some of these bugs basically allowed you potentially to like control your machine remotely, but again, these are fixed, so no worries. But I guess, as you mentioned, like the more interesting maybe are the kind of bugs that are directly in the application, for instance, like VLC or Firefox. For VLC, basically we find a denial of denial of service, so that means that when you try to play a video with some specific magic byte, what's happening is that if you have these bytes in your encoded data, you try to play a video and that's crashed and will never like be able to actually allow you to play this specific video is these magic bytes are there. Because that's again is a problem with interaction with the software and the lower layers. And then we will get a little bit too much technical maybe. But
you could potentially like crash, I don't know, if there's an application. I don't know. I mean, if someone is using VLC to display a video in a presentation, you could crash that.
Yes, let's say that hopefully someone tested before, so is aware that the video will crash. But let's say that if potentially you have a video uploaded in the cloud and then you download it, but someone change it that in this kind of bit flip that maybe you change really small stuff that the video looks the same, but it's not. Maybe you are showing a video in the movie theater, let's say, in a cinema. And then, for instance, half of the movie, the video crash, and people, of course, could get angry. But yes, that's maybe a little bit annoying.
It's also a bit outlandish. But still, I mean, there are you never know what you will find as bugs in the beginning, right?
Exactly. And we try anyway to make everything more as robust as possible. So that's something that we should consider as researcher.
Definitely. Not every bug has to be like the big scary bug that you can print at the front of a tabloid and tell people that you are all gonna die.
We don't need to be too dramatic.
Yeah.
then some other bugs, for instance, allowed an attacker if you're hosting these videos or your, for instance, you have a web page that allowed you to stream videos. If you have some of this bug and you're actually using this library or this software, could potentially allow an attacker to remotely control your machine as well.
Okay. Which sounds more scary.
That's a bit more scary, but that's required more technical expertise than just play a video potentially. Yeah. So of course that's could escalate easily if you don't patch this bug. Yeah. So they are actually a really strong hazard indication of your system should not be acting like that.
Yeah.
In addition, we found another bugs in Firefox. Where basically there was a problem with the communication between the browser and the actual hardware part that should accelerate the video processing and the video decoding. And what's happening here is that actually found an information leak that basically we can play a video from one of the tab of our browser. So basically we are rendering this video, the video is playing. Then from another tab, we basically have this kind of reader that basically does by default does not render anything. It's just a green screen basically. But when the other video in the tab is playing, that's basically right on memory on the hardware part, or at least that's our guess, because again, like, black box is still a bit challenging to understand actually what's the concrete cause, and could be even a combination of reasons. Basically what's happening is that we have this tab that play a video, and from another tab we can actually read what what the user is actually playing on the other side.
Which is also kind of bad news, because there should be isolation between
not expected to actually leak from one tab or to the other. I mean, you potentially still to be the same user that use it, but if you play a video, you close it, you leave the room, someone come, play this kind of script or actually is already there running, then you can actually see some information of what the other user, the previous user could be playing before.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, yeah, right. So, and in your paper, you also mentioned the possibility of fingerprinting hardware based on how it decodes video. What does that mean? And can you maybe explain how it works, what privacy implications could be?
Sure. So again, like, we are talking, of course, about academic work. So like, I hope that people are not getting, of course, scared about that or anything. Yeah. Basically what's happening is that this chip, that is this hardware accelerators, are basically having a kind of tiny signature or a kind of accent that basically when they decode that, they can introduce this kind of signature, this kind of information or this kind of disparities between the frame. And basically we analyze giving the same input to different platform that we test. We saw that basically everyone for specific cases, given a specific input, was decoding this video in a different manner, leaving this kind of accent or this kind of signature that in the end we call fingerprinting.
Yeah.
And so potentially what's could happen is that you give this specific input to different machines, or at least the one that we tested, because we can just talk about the one that we test. Yeah, but of course, if someone is willing, could like scale the studies or everything, please, if you want. But yeah, so basically giving these specific inputs that we actually generate with our fuzzing approach, we give it to a different platform, they decode it with this hardware component. And basically, we can actually see that this input is generated or actually rendered as a video in different way on different platforms. So basically, okay, with some studies, we were able to say, okay, given an input, we can actually identify which platform more likely you're using, mm-hmm, based on our testing cluster.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Again, I mean, as you said, not a scary thing for users to be afraid of, but still interesting. I mean, even in parts where you wouldn't expect like that many bugs to be, there is a lot, right? And it can only give us the idea, I mean, how many bugs there are to still find in all kinds of software, right? So
yeah, for sure. Like there is a lot of work that could be done. And of course, like industry or developers tend to focus on the functionalities because of mm-hmm course the user want more feature, more options.
And they want to make money. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So, everyone has its kind of business, of course, or yeah, that kind of... and in the end, of course, like that is just a sign that a lot of work is needed and that we can always do better somehow. Yeah. And we need always to, I mean, at least I guess that technology need to be accessible to everyone, but yeah, on their side need to have some guarantees, and we need to continue to do some work to continue to have strong guarantees for the final user, at least on a functional and either security perspective.
Yeah. As I said, even if it's not like the big scary bug in front of on the front page of the tabloid, it's still worth fixing, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. We still have to do some work. Some work is still there to, we could improve.
Yeah. So jumping on that, you said that TwinFuzz, you actually tried the hardware acceleration part as a sort of experiment or to get into the part of hardware testing. So you could actually probably apply the TwinFuzz to a lot of other things.
Yes,
right?
Potentially, yes. Basically, our testing strategy was developed for address acceleration in the context of video decoding. Mm-hmm. But the basic takeaway is that you can apply this strategy to whatever stack that have a white box model, so of software reference, or, I mean, it does not need to be software, but just something that you can actually see what's going on.
Yeah.
And another system that does not give you any introspection and does not allow you to understand clearly what's going on under the hood. And basically, you can compare these two systems, given the fact that they should actually be deterministic and give the same output, of course, because if we talk about machine learning or artificial intelligence, of course, this thing change a bit.
Yeah,
but given two models, a white box where like could be a software that you can introspect, a black box that you cannot. Basically, that's a technique allowed you to have when you have a deterministic process, so you give a specific input, you expect a specific output. Mm-hmm. Can we always spread it to other components between software, hardware, or could be a little bit, could be more generalized potentially, yes, mm-hmm, and apply to different domains.
Okay, okay, interesting. Then maybe let's get back to the sort of very beginning. Back to the problem of the black box testing. I can imagine that in general is a problem for security, right? You as a system tester that wants to make sure that hardware and software, everything works correctly. For you, shouldn't everything be easily testable or as easily testable as possible?
Yes. In idealistic work, yes. we would like that we could actually investigate everything. We could understand what's going on, but there are some domains like hardware, or if you think about firmware, where basically the developers or the companies develop specific code that they don't want to release. Mm-hmm. So they obfuscate this code, they encrypt it, or they kind of try to hide their way of implementing this stuff. Otherwise, someone can take it and reproduce it. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, for business could be a little bit an issue. But there are other components that are actually just complex and like these chips where manufacturer has just the goal to say, you give me an input, I optimize all the circuit and I give you the output. So even for that kind of goal is not needed to actually like give you access to this technology. And again, for the business, it's not really recommended, I guess.
We often talk about like a security through obscurity when it comes to that, like, mm-hmm, which is basically goes in the direction of that black box, that usually is not a good idea, right? So someone will find out because people are smart.
Yes, there are, of course, some advantages of doing black box software, where, for instance, the company can have some guarantees that people cannot replicate their strategy or their product, and especially with the software, that's usually the case. That's even why, actually, we get software by license, and you have actually to...
Makes sense, yeah.
That's basically a solution to the problem. So yeah, for sure, like having black box components makes stuff a little bit harder, but for the average user maybe to understand what's going on. But of course, when maybe some expertise focus on that and spent months or years reverse engineering like all the structure and so on, you don't then have a guarantee that your black box will then...
still be a black box. Yeah. Maybe it's a gray box at the end.
In the end, yes. So let's say that you should not expect your guarantees on just black box.
Like, yeah. Okay. When we consider all of this research, the average user is, do they even have to care at this point? As you said, it's like small bugs. They don't really break a lot of stuff. Still worth fixing, but usually... let's say it's hard to imagine that someone will empty their bank accounts just because they stream a video. So should the average user even care, or is it something that is just purely academic?
So even if you never heard the word of hardware acceleration, for instance, in the end, affect you every day. Is the technology that is around us and that we use daily for our course, for our Netflix, on TV and so on. So... let's say that the final user should somehow care, because I think it's nice just to be aware of the world that's around us and the somehow, of course, nothing that you need to be expertise with, but knowing a bit the technology that you're using is, of course, something that could make you a more safe user in your daily life and be aware of the potential threat that you can have. So I feel like being informed is always a good way of prevention.
It's just nice to know that the thing you're carrying around in your pocket is a very complex system with lots of gears and cogs, you know? Just there has to be a lot of things are going right if you can use that thing daily in your lifetime.
Yeah, let's say, even if you're not a security expert, it could impact you every day. And I feel like knowing how much this kind of threat could actually impact the user or the final user could be good for everyone, because we don't want to anyway scare the people and saying like, please don't use the technology, throw away your laptop.
Yeah, never the goal.
Exactly. So we are just trying to prevent malicious people or malicious attacker to actually ends up exploiting people's data or privacy. So I feel like knowing the technology underlying in some degree, at some degree, or at least having a feeling about that, I think could help people to even understand how much they should be scared of technology.
And
for nowadays, I think we are pretty safe and we should not be too much worried if everyone develops stuff or plan the system in a good way. So I guess industry develop is functional, security should give guarantees on final user is not in danger.
So for me, the main takeaway of this, of your paper and also of this conversation is again that there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood when it comes to technology that the average user or even like me will never know about, or other people might not actually really care about, but you know, all of these things are interacting with us daily. So, and I'm always like, whenever I talk to people here at CISPA, I'm always very surprised on how deep you can dig and figure out stuff that, oh, wow, you did test that. I mean, how do you even get to that? Do you also still have these moments where you're like other people, like other researchers, and you're like, okay, why did you even think of testing that? That's genius. I mean,
yeah, I think here at CISPA, there are really a lot of people that work on really different topics. And sometimes, yes, I really agree that I see the people, I chat with them, and then they maybe tell me that they're working on some completely different topic than mine. And I really like don't get how they reach it or how they figured out this topic. But I think in the end, with technology, you always need to be somehow updated on the edge and cut technology or so on. So yeah, there is always something interesting that you can work on in the end. For sure, there is enough work that we could potentially do for a lot of years if we want to really guarantee a really robust and secure system or ecosystem in the technology stack.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this field so particularly interesting. Okay, Matteo, thank you very much. That was very insightful, also very fun.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting. Same for me.
I can't let you go yet because, as is tradition, I have time. We have some time for a few quick fire questions.
Sure.
So, can you even still watch Reels on your phone without thinking about the hardware acceleration stack?
Yeah. For the moment, I mean, since we report this bug, people are informed. Potentially, now there will be some interest in this kind of domain and more research could be done. But yeah, for now, you can scroll your Reels and don't be worried about that.
Yeah. Okay. So what is the most surprising thing you have learned in your cybersecurity research so far? If you could instantly solve one cybersecurity problem, what would it be?
So maybe one of the cybersecurity problems that I would like to magically solve would be like the robustness in supply chain security. Mm-hmm. So basically the fact that we often don't know what code is running on our device and what this code is able to do. So I feel having robust or secure development in this kind of direction could be really nice.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I think a lot of your colleagues would agree. If AI could take over one part of your work as a researcher, what would you happily hand off to it?
So potentially for me, that could be paperwork, I guess. Nowadays, I guess even with the code generation, we're at a good stage. So feeling free to think about the problem and only the problem without actually maybe spending a lot of time developing the solution, that could be really nice because people could just try to think about something and somehow make it happen in a code without having too much expertise, and maybe they can feel more free to test.
Yeah.
That could maybe speed up more their kind of developing and find potential solution to problem that we maybe are facing or we will face.
Yeah, makes sense. So last question before I let you go. If you weren't in research, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
I think I will be studying music at that time if I were not doing research or computer science related activities,
All right, that's a change of venue, I guess.
Yeah. I actually used to have a band, a couple of bands time ago, but actually the others continue with the music. I'm the only one that moved to research, so.
Yeah, so maybe there's a way back if this doesn't work out.
Never too late for start to play any instrument, so yeah, for sure.
All right, Matteo, thank you very much. I had a lot of fun. I hope to see you again sometime here. And all the best for your future research.
Thank you so much. Dan, thank you for inviting me.
And that's it for this episode of CISPA TLDR. Big thanks to Matteo Leonelli for joining us and sharing his insights into the fascinating world of software testing and for showing us what actually happens in your phone when you go on a reel scrolling binge. If you want to learn more about Matteo's work, check out the links in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating if you're feeling generous. It really helps others find the show. I'm Tobias Ebelshäuser, thanks for listening, and see you next time, when we'll dive into the next big topic in cybersecurity and AI without all the complicated stuff.